De un apartamento pulga infestado vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. It's Bat Segundo!
Yes, thank you, Jorge, for that effusive ole. It really helps after a handful of Advil when you've had a paroxysm of Spanish ecstasy. Wonderful. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, here dragged against his will, not entirely, because, well, a bottle of tequila really does stack the odds against you. You see, the intrepid young interviewer decided to cover this thing called BEA, which apparently stands for Book Expo America, although for me it reminds me of the woman who broke my heart, B. She taught me how to drink, she taught me how to smoke, she taught me how to tie my shoe. I weep. Anyway, our intrepid young interviewer went by the Melville House booth. Melville House, not necessarily having anything to do specifically with Mr. Herman, publishes a variety of titles, such as manifestos, the works of Stephen Dixon, and a variety of other things. Our intrepid young interviewer, whose panties got a bit too soiled, decided to talk with Dennis Lloyd Johnson and his wife, Valerie something. Well, he'll go ahead and tell you. For the moment, I'm going to strangle Jorge while you listen up.
Hello, Ed Champion here again from Book Expo, and I'm sitting here in the Melville House booth with the famous Dennis Lloyd Johnson and Valerie Martins. So, Dennis, can you tell me, first of all, how has BEA been for you so far?
Well, Ed, the doors have been open for about 20 minutes, and it's just starting to fill up. We're pretty excited. Can't really give a report so far, but we're psyched. Lots of meetings coming, and a hot list we're very excited about, so we're looking forward to it.
I see you've got an upcoming book on the Beatles by Lewis Lapham. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, we're very excited about that because I'm both a Beatles freak and a Lewis Lapham freak. And both have been very inspiring to me in my own work, so it's kind of a thrill to get them both together. But it's a cool book. Lewis, in the 60s, you know, was one of the so-called new journalists like Tom Wolfe, etc. And he went to India when the Beatles went to India. It was a pretty famous time in 68, just after the Summer of Love and right during the Tet Offensive. So it was kind of a turning point in the 60s culture. And Lewis was the only reporter who went into the ashram with the Beatles, so he really has the inside scoop. And all these great 60s icons were there. Besides the Beatles, I mean, the Beach Boys were there, and Donovan was there. And Mia Farrow was there. She'd just been kicked off the yacht by her husband, Frank Sinatra. And so there were all kinds of great gossipy stories there. But it was also a great, great and interesting cultural moment. So we're really pleased with this book. It's a good piece of journalism.
Has any of this stuff been published before, or is this a brand new?
It's somewhere in between. Lewis, of course, was there as a reporter for the Saturday Evening Post, and he filed a couple of stories on it at the time, and those are kind of the germ of the book. The book is going to be, it's going to be a short book. It's going to be an expansion of those and all the stuff that he couldn't put in the Saturday Evening Post, which was a kind of a mainstream, genteel publication. He can put in the book. So he's been telling me stories at lunch for years about what went on in the compound, I finally convinced him that those would be good additions and make a worthy book.
Have you been sort of inundated with, since you seem to specialize in, like, for example, taking a particular piece that was filed at a magazine and then sort of expanding them into book form, have you been inundated with manuscripts, or do you have anything else coming up along those lines?
Yeah, we're actually doing a whole series called the Melville Manifestos series Valerie and I are doing, which is kind of exactly that idea. We're trying to hearken back to the pamphleting age when books were journalism and were news. And we think now, with the failings of the mainstream media, that books can take up a lot of the slack and perform that function again. So we're going to be doing a series of short books. They're not reprints, but maybe we saw a journalist writing about something and we said, look, do you have a polemic about that? Do you have a manifesto about that? Do you have a short investigation about that that would make a good, hard-hitting, inexpensive book? We're trying to make these small, inexpensive books and that are just more timely than it's used to. Melville House, as Valerie can chime in on, we've become, unfortunately, famous for making books really fast. And it's been really killing. But we do think that books can be made on shorter than the two-year cycle that's normal in publishing. And maybe that way we can make up for what's going on in mainstream media.
I'll get into the 2 year. I'll get to the youth Valerie very soon because I don't want this to be this the Danish show. But in terms of the 2 year cycle, what is your average sort of cycle for a Melville House title, and how do you go about doing this? Maybe Valerie might chime in with how that's done.
Melville House cycle, my goodness. Usually we see something, fall in love with it, and run with it as fast as we can. Unfortunately, publishing does have certain constraints. It's a very slow moving beast. And we're trying to speed it up a little bit, but we're getting tired.
Yeah.
But the usual cycle for a book is about a year and a half. But for us, I would say it's about 9 months, really.
And then it really varies.
It really does vary. It really does vary. I mean, we did a book in 3 weeks, and that was very exciting and almost killed us. But I think it was worth it. So the nice thing about Melville House is we're small and light, and we can adjust quickly if we see something we feel needs to be out in front of the public. We feel we can get it out there fast. So that's kind of nice.
Well, for other publishers who hope to maybe publish something out in 3 weeks or definitely less than the year and a half cycle, do you have any tips to impart?
Oh, my.
Don't do that.
Don't do that. It hurts. There's a reason why they have a nice leisurely cycle. It's a big country. It's got to get distributed throughout the United States. Everyone has to learn about it, all the booksellers.
That's the issue. I mean, the business, the structure.
It's the structure of the business.
People really don't understand. Most writers, even published authors, don't really understand how the apparatus works. And it's very complicated, and there are many parts. And the business itself doesn't like books made at beyond a certain speed, because you have to make booksellers aware of a book that involves a catalog, that involves a certain amount of time to make the catalog.
Sales reps on the road.
Sales reps need to go out and represent that book. You need a certain amount of time to actually physically make a book, which is a longer time than you would think. You need a month process to fully distribute a book. And so that's why the average mainstream publisher, conglomerate publisher, likes to have about an 18-month or two-year cycle of processing a book. So when we crash a book, as it's known, it's a fight. It's a real fight where you have to go to people out of schedule and beg them for their attention and their time and space in their store. I mean, the book Valerie mentioned, What We Do Now, was a book that we made right after the election last year, the presidential election. And we were trying to get places in stores in December, the busiest month of the year for booksellers. And they've already got their store full. They have no space left. So it was quite a struggle. And that's why these times are kind of standard. And if you want to go against that, it's a fight. But publishing is a fight anyway, so we decide to take it on every now and then when we feel it's worth it. And luckily for us, people have responded when we've done it. But there could be a time where nobody responds, and then we'll both be in physical pain and other kinds of pain. So it's a risk.
One last question. There have been sort of repeated sort of struggles of other publishers trying to get, books into chains, into like the Barnes & Nobles and the Amazons, et cetera. Have you faced anything along those lines, any problems?
Not really. We have had a lot of success with the chains, and I say that as someone who for years, as you know, Ed, was a great critic of the chain booksellers. I do feel that they're having a negative impact on our culture. But as a businessman, I can't say that they turned down my far-left political book, for example. If they think it's something, it's a pretty straightforward business deal. If they think they can make money off it, they'll buy it from you. It's really that simple. Where it gets complicated is in kinds of pressures that you are under for the look of a book, for display money, for different kinds of display deals. There, the big boys are the 800-pound gorilla, and they might throw their weight around a little bit. But I can't say that I felt, and they know who I am. I've walked into many a meeting with a Barnes & Noble executive where they've said, oh, you're that Moby Lives guy. You're that guy that wrote about us. Well, we like this book. We'll take 2,000. So I have to hand it to them. I mean, really, the behemoth for us is Amazon, not the brick-and-mortar stores. Amazon is always the complicated one to deal with. And they're very difficult. They're very difficult. They're difficult in a business sense, and they're difficult in an informational sense, because every single one of our books, I believe, that's up on Amazon right now has some crucial bit of information wrong. A price, a title, an author, a publisher, a pub date, an ISBN number that we can't get them to fix. No matter what. So there's all kinds of issues with Amazon as a huge behemoth retailer, but not with the real world stores.
I want to go back to the issue of covers. When you design the covers, knowing that some brick and mortar stores kind of will object to certain covers, is this a consideration when you design, or is there sort of a separation between, you know, the nice look of your covers and the marketing therein?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, it is sort of a tightrope walk, but we always err on the side of art. I mean, you know, we feel like it's the buyer of the book. You know, it's the person who wants to read that book who's going to buy it. It's not that Barnes & Noble executive. And yes, books can get lost in their big stores. They're very noisy. There's a lot of visual information. But we feel like if we make a beautiful book and a desirable, I mean, you know, a beautiful book is a beautiful book, and you want to hold it, you want to read it, you want to own it. At least that's the way I feel about it as a book lover, and I'm just projecting my feelings upon others, and I think actually it's a successful way to make choices about book design. You know, we do things like we don't put blurbs on books. The only time we put blurbs on a book was a reader's manifesto, and we put both good and bad blurbs, which we thought was hysterical, of course, when a lot of people were confused. But we tend to just, if it's a beautiful design and it makes sense for the book, it's a whole package, and we don't want to change that. So
it's something that makes us different. I mean, both Valerie and I are artists. You know, we're new publishers. We've only been publishers for 3 or 4 years, and we came at this as artists, and we really fight for art.
Have you considered, in terms of, you published Stephen Dixon's Old Friends? Have you been in touch with Stephen, or are you? In other words, are you publishing another book by him? Yeah, now I see that Valerie is pointing to... Yeah, can you tell me about that?
Absolutely. We're going to tell him about phone rings.
Well, it's... I think we're now Stephen's publishers. We've got several books lined up to do with him, and we're really pleased about that. The last one just got nothing but rave reviews, and I think the next one is even better. He's really kind of hitting a stride. He's reached a certain kind of nice balance between being an experimental or avant-gardist writer and a more accessible writer, I think, for a mainstream audience. But he's just really writing, this is a very beautiful family story. And, you know, there's a really great beauty. I think his books, as he's aged, he's really distilled something about the family experience and brotherhood and sisterhood and parenthood. That's really, really beautiful, and we're really pretty thrilled about where his books are going. We've seen the next several now. He's very prolific, so we know what's coming up, and it just is really great stuff.
Well, what do you say? You've seen the next several. How many books are we talking about here?
A lot of what we're talking about is ideas. A lot of what we're talking about is manuscripts. He's got a lot of uncollected stories and things like that that we're trying to figure out what, you know, how to package, what we would do with them. And he just, you know, he's writing all the time, and he writes pretty fast. So I would suspect that we'll be doing a collection with him at some point in the future. I don't want to put a date on it, but that'll probably be what's next, and I'm sure he's at work on the next novel right now. So,
have you thought of maybe a Stephen Dixon reader of some kind? Or?
Well, we have. We're really tossing around a lot of ideas about what to do, but I suspect we'll be doing some kind of behemoth collection at some point.
Thanks a lot.
as if talking to those two wasn't enough for this young Hunter S. Thompson wannabe, our young intrepid journalist talked with David Kippen. Mr. Kippen is a critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. He is a tall man who I know I can drink under the table. He hosts a radio show in Southern California, whose name I have conveniently forgotten. I assure you, it is not as good as mine. Mr. Kippen has a book coming out through Melville House that dares to supplant the auteur theory. Boy, what an ambitious man. I was ambitious once. Look where it got me.
Okay, so I'm here with David Kippen, who just popped in really as a surprise. He is, of course, he writes for the San Francisco Chronicle, which is my hometown newspaper. But I have learned, amazingly, that he has a book here for Melville House. So maybe, David, you could tell me about that.
Yes, I'd be delighted. This is an exclusive for you. I won't be telling anybody about this book all weekend. It's called The Schreiber Theory, A Radical Rewrite of American Film History. And it's an attempt to restore screenwriters to their rightful place at the center of the filmmaking process. There was, as you probably know, something about 50 years ago called the auteur theory, which yes. insists that directors are in fact the authors of their films, which is arrant hogwash, to my mind, although there is certainly a case to be made for, and it would be nice to see the sort of relative specific gravities of filmmaking equalized so that they can share their equal part. But until that day happens, I'm going overboard and involving something called the Schreiber theory. Auteur is French for author. Schreiber, Yiddish for writer. Yiddish, of course, being the native tongue of most of the people who invented what we think of as the golden age of modern screenwriting.
Well, the risk here is that it's going to be confused with Schreiner.
The Schreiner thing? No. That's something else again. No. We've as you can tell, my impeccable editors at Melville House would not let a title onto the cover of one of their books without running it past all kinds of focus groups and spending millions of dollars in pre-market analysis. And they have ascertained that The Schreiber Theory, A Radical Rewrite of American Film History, is the optimal title for such a book as this. Coming out next January, with the idea being that we're going to sort of body surf the Oscar wave throughout the entire spring, and never having done this before, having been for all my life on the consumer end rather than the producer end of publishing books, I will now understand what it's like to have the crap kicked out of me for a change instead of doing it to other people.
So do you focus on specific writers like Ring Lardner or Ben Hecht?
Definitely in there, yes, and Ben Hecht. But I mean, the idea is to look at a screenwriter's career longitudinally, you know, sort of from beginning to end, and trace the evolution of themes, which are common to all of his work. And if you do this long enough, as we've been conditioned to do for directors, but not for screenwriters, what you discover is that the filmographies of certain screenwriters hang together far better than those of any directors do. Ben Hecht would be a perfect example. I mean, you know,
Paddy Chayefsky.
I'm so glad you brought him up. Chayefsky is sort of an interesting study here, because if you look at his work closely, it's basically the closest he is movies natural existentialist. You know, what James M. Cain was to pulp writing, I think you can say Chayefsky was to existentialist filming. I mean, look at a movie like Altered States. That movie is about the search for some sort of essential human characteristics. And at the end, it comes down to William Hurt making his own mark. I mean, he sort of discovers that, you know, love, how he feels about Blair Brown, is more important than any sort of primal, essential, mystical, human essence that he can isolate. Same thing with, did you ever see The Americanization of Emily?
I never did.
Oh, God, that's a masterpiece.
And I've heard about it.
Just a brilliant movie directed by a total hack, Arthur Hiller, who also made Love Story, who also made Teachers, one of the worst movies of all time.
And Silver Streak.
Silver Streak, yes. I mean, there are, you know, while it's nice to make the case for the Schreiber theory positively and point to all these great screenwriters like Chayefsky, whose signature is unmistakable, it's almost just as good to point to a movie like The Americanization of Emily, directed by a total non-entity who couldn't ruin it because Chayefsky's voice is so unmistakable, so strong, and so witty. I mean, that's a movie about a guy who basically winds up saying, to hell with my country. Well, I am what matters. My love for Julie Andrews, which is, you know, a much more beautiful love affair than you see in Victor Victoria between her and James Garner 20 years later. You know, it's quintessential existentialism, if that's not a contradiction in terms. And, you know, if you just look at the movies as a group rather than as, you know, isolated instances of other directors' filmographies, they are, you know, they belong, like, bound in a Library of America volume, because they're that cohesive.
Okay, question about the Schreiber theory, and this I hate to debunk it, I mean, it sounds, like, really good, but what... What do you do in terms of, like, the rewrites?
Well, what you do with the rewrites is, frankly, you go back and do some film scholarship. Because, you know, these companies have archives. I've done a little bit of it, but, I mean, this is a 150-page manifesto. The idea is to make it a prolegomenon that, it lays the groundwork for a whole lot of comprehensive study down the road, because the auteur theory basically has a 50-year head start on us. And before it becomes too ingrained in everybody's heads, if it isn't already, I think a rival theory is necessary to restore some equilibrium. But, I mean, the other thing you do from here on out, I mean, in addition to going back with film scholarship and finding, unearthing lost contributions to screenplays whose credits have been misapplied, what you want to do going forward is create basically a position like the Directors Guild trainee position on a film set, where you've got a Writers Guild trainee who can catalog the travails of the script. He has no influence. He can't protect the script. I mean, that's more than anybody can hope for. But he will at least be able to create on a website some sort of evidence of how the script started, what it went through, how it got where he is. Because nowadays with the internet, this is possible. Nowadays with DVDs, you can have screenwriter tracks. And if the studios are too reluctant to give you a screenwriter track, then you create a podcast track on the Writers Guild website. And you can listen to the screenwriter as you're watching the movie and find out just how it was horribly mangled along the way.
So what do you do then for like something like Citizen Kane, which is co-written by Joseph Mankiewicz and Orson Welles, and both of them fantastic talents?
Both of them fantastic talents. Well, what you do, in fact, I've given this a lot of thought, if you have looked at the whole Mankiewicz catalog, or as much of it is available, which is a lot more than used to be thanks to things like Netflix, and if, even unless you already know it, which is quite likely because he was also, you know, one of the greatest directors of all times, you know the Welles catalog, then it becomes sort of a challenge in critical acumen to tease out what would be one man's contributions versus the other man's contributions. And it's possible in the same way that a Lennon-McCartney song. You know, you listen to Revolution and you know that probably, even though it's credited to Lennon-McCartney, Paul McCartney didn't have a whole lot to do with the composition of Revolution. Similarly, Yesterday does not sound like a John Lennon song. It sounds like a Paul McCartney song.
Are you familiar with the book Beatles Songs?
Beatles, no.
It's really good. It came out maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and basically it goes by through all the songs and goes like percentage Lennon, percentage McCartney, and it's really a great...
Sounds fascinating. Well, this could be a model for what we're doing, Beatles Songs.
Yeah, well, it is, and it basically uses like, you know, interview fragments and everything to sort of support its theory about like, okay, this is 100% Lennon, this is 70% Lennon. It's really, really good, yeah.
The other model would be Monty Python.
Yeah.
I mean, there are no writing credits on the sketches,
but you know it's a Chapman Cleese one.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, the example would be, you know, look at a movie like The Firm, which came out a few years ago. The romantic stuff, that's got to be, I think his name is David Rayfield. You know, the construction stuff, that's probably Robert Towne. You know what these guys' specialties are.
Well, Robert Towne also did like... who was the doctor on Mission Impossible 2?
I want to say
that Robert Towne did some sort of doctoring work on that.
I think he may have a screenwriting.
But you couldn't see it though. I mean, you know, either it was completely rewritten over, or you know, it's just not there. Or he did, you know, like the one unfortunate movie that he directed with the
Personal Best.
Yes,
like Personal Best. I mean, it was a better script than a movie. But this is what happens oftentimes when screenwriters basically turn their back on what is their calling. And what happens all too often is they become directors, and before you know it, they're directing other people's scripts. And the movies lose whatever personal stamp they might originally have had when they actually had their name on the script as well as the directing credit.
What about writers like Billy Wilder, who have always required like a writing partner, whether it was I.L. Diamond or the other guys that he... Charles Brackett, yeah.
Nobody would ever think to take away Billy Wilder's authorship of all of these marvelous movies. But if you look at the Wilder career, you can see that the movies he wrote with Brackett up until they broke on Sunset Boulevard, they're quite different from the movies with Diamond. The Brackett movies are a little bit more sentimental. He sort of muted Wilder's Viennese cynicism. Then I.L. Diamond comes along, and you can look at a movie like...
There's a sudden quirkiness. Yeah.
Yes, it's quirkiness, and also the cynicism runs rampant.
Yeah.
And there's even a sort of smuttiness later on as,
Dirty Old Men.
Yes, exactly. But, I mean, the turning point, I think, is a movie like Love in the Afternoon. Because that's a movie about Gary Cooper as a playboy finally settling down, which in a certain sense is quite autobiographical for Wilder at this point in his life, because he had broken several years before with Brackett on Sunset Boulevard, and he was playing the field. He was writing one movie with one guy, he was writing another movie with another guy. He was looking for somebody to settle down with, and when he found Izzy Diamond, what does he do? He goes to work on Love in the Afternoon, which is a movie about a playboy settling down. If you just train yourself to look beyond the possessory credit, this god-awful apostrophe which the Directors Guild has inflicted on us, and many films actually, have their directorial credits, that's as much a fiction as the screenwriting credit, because, you know, directing is such a quicksilver art, if it even is an art, that, it's only the Directors Guild's contractual insistence on a single director that has perpetuated this myth of movies as a head birth from one guy. If the Writers Guild would, frankly, grow a spine, and a lot of the writers in it be less willing to rewrite their brother writers, I think movies would get a little better. And I think writers' stature as creative artists on a par with directors would be an easier case to make.
Well, okay, there's also, like, for example, the Nicholas Meyer adaptation of the Philip Roth novel, The Human State, where he somehow managed to negotiate, on the main thing, Nicholas Meyer's, written by Nicholas Meyer. I mean, this is a case where, because in order for Robert Benton to get the rights,
right,
he had to actually credit written by Nicholas Meyer as well. And this is kind of a rare case where you actually see that it's a twofold process. There's a writer and a director. And I think the
Schreiber theory.
Schreiber theory. Yes. Why am I thinking Scrivener theory?
Don't think that.
Okay, I won't. It's because we view, unfortunately, screenwriters, unfortunately, there's a perception of them as hacks, and that's not entirely the case. But where was I going with this?
You're going with the Human Stain, and I didn't know. So, presumably Roth gets credit as, the source, source material.
But
Benton wrote a lot of it, and Meyer had contractual...
No, Benton directed.
Right.
But Meyer, by virtue of having the rights and Benton wanting to make the movie...
Oh, I see.
...got basically a full-blown written by Nicholas Meyer credit.
What should it have been?
Well, that's the question. Who comes first? But the thing is every single trailer, like in big, bold lights, written by Nicholas Meyer.
Right.
And as well as directed by Robert Benton. Mm-hmm. And on the posters, written by Nicholas Meyer, directed by Robert Benton. So this was a rare case where the writer almost actually won. But I'm trying to tie this into your book, and I ended up rambling.
Well, it seems as if, there are a lot more opportunities nowadays for truth-telling in the allocation of credit or blame in the filmmaking process. I mean, with something like imdb.com, you can click on a screenwriter and you can see his filmography from soup to nuts. In the instance of Nicholas Meyer, you will see that, he started out writing,
Sub-Percept Solution.
Yes, the adaptations of the Holmes pastiches, and then gradually got into directing, and as is so often the case, he sort of lost his way, became a director for hire, and turned his back on his greatest gift because he realized, whereas with somebody like Robert Benton, who started out doing those wonderful screenplays with David Newman, they came out of Esquire and they did Bonnie and Clyde, they did a terrific unproduced script called Hubba Hubba, which, by the way, is a sort of side publishing thing I'm doing with Red Hand. I'm going to be publishing a lot of unproduced screenplays.
That's another thing. Writers who turn directors like Robert Rossen and
What was I just reading about Robert Rossen? One of his best pictures is what did he do that was an adaptation of I'm going to blank now.
Not
The Hustler.
Not HUD.
But there's an interesting case. Somebody like Larry McMurtry.
Yeah.
Who's got a tremendous grasp of the film medium, has written wonderfully about it, has written a couple of good screenplays and also miniseries when he adapts his own work. These are the people who deserve to have their contributions to films restored, which have so often been, plowed under by the unthinking assumption that a movie is a director's work, beginning and ending.
Well, do you also address, though, beyond the writers turning directors, do you also address, like, for example, the Charlie Kaufmans of our world? The Charlie Kaufman situation is odd because here's a guy who, he's only known because it's obviously a distinctive stamp, but it's an eccentric stamp.
Very
and the only way for a writer to get recognized is not to do anything quiet, but to actually go ahead and be, like, completely crazy, adaptation, write yourself into a fake twin brother. Do you address this particular...
I talk a little bit about Kaufman, but I hadn't thought about it in terms of very self-aggrandizing move, which is ironic for somebody like Kaufman, who is, you know, if anything, a recluse, to write a movie with himself in it, which, of course, foregrounds the screenwriter's contribution. And what I've been doing when I talk about this book is, you know, oftentimes the first thing I'll say is, who's your favorite screenwriter? And people go, you know, either they stare off into space, or the best they can do is Charlie Kaufman. Not that he's not a wonderful screenwriter. Then, of course, they turn around and say, who's your favorite director? And they're, like, staring into a different part of space, thinking, you know, which of the dozen people who immediately leap to mind should I come up with. Kaufman nowadays has created a brand to the point where he even does an adaptation. He does Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and people think of that, you know, not as a Chuck Barris movie, certainly.
Not even as a George
Clooney movie. It's a Kaufman movie.
Yeah.
And I think he is not the only person who deserves this sort of attention. Certainly not the only contemporary person, but much more so, he's not the only person that you could look at in all of film history and recover all these names that are barely known to us now. Dudley Nichols, who wrote, you know, Bringing Up Baby and Stagecoach. I mean, two movies, two classics, as disparate as you could possibly happen, because then, you know, they worked for studios who, you know, for all of their vulgarity, trusted a writer and did not insist on pigeonholing him, whereas now, writers often have more of a stamp than they otherwise would just because you do one thing and they just want you to do it again and again and again.
Okay, well, going back to Billy Wilder really quick. Okay,
yeah, sure,
Double Indemnity.
Yeah.
Written by James Cain, the novel, screenplay by Raymond Chandler. Yet, it is indisputably, I would argue, a Billy Wilder movie. How would you respond to that? I mean, what makes that, you know, because Billy Wilder had almost nothing to do with it except, you know, calling Chandler. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, there are cases which need to be excavated where, you know, the writer, you know, credit has been completely misassigned. You know, based on, you know, nothing more significant than, like, who Irving Thalberg was playing golf with that week. These are instances where you've got to go into the salt mines and you've got to, you know, reinscribe into film history a lot of these forgotten people who lived wonderful, interesting lives. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, these guys have, you know, enormous catalogs of letters, which you can... Have you ever read Dalton Trumbo's letters?
No.
Oh, God. Screenwriters' letters and editors' letters are the greatest resource because these are people who are not themselves, who are not pouring every ounce of their creative energies into their own work. You know, they are thwarted many times and deferential to other people. So, oftentimes, the full flower of their creativity only comes out when they're writing these bitchy letters. And so, you know, you need, in these instances, to look at, you know, let's see, where was I going with this? You need to do the research and basically reassign some, you know, when in the 50s, when a lot of writers were blacklisted, and, you know, it wasn't so much a question of the wrong people getting credit for the movies. It was non-existent people getting credit for the movies. People running behind fronts,
It took, like, you know, ages before Michael Wilson
got his credit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, it was given to Pierre Boulez instead. Yeah. He didn't speak a word of English. Similarly with The Brave One by Dalton Trumbo, you know, where it was credited to Robert Rich, who did not exist, and the Academy had egg on its face because they'd given an Oscar to a man who was never born. You know, I think you could do as comprehensive, if not more so, a revisionist history as the Writers Guild did when it went back and tried to unscramble all of the credits that the blacklist had miswritten.
The thing is, how do you deal with disputes with such a system?
Well, in some cases, mercifully, the writers would be dead.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not necessarily advocating for changing the credits, which they've done on Roman Holiday, which was a Dalton Trumbo script that wound up credited to, not a script, but a treatment, a screen story, credited, I think, to Ian McClellan Hunter. You go back and, with supplemental information, either on the internet or on the DVD, you gradually, if not change the credits, you do the sort of thing that was done with Chinatown, with The Godfather, where at this point, you know, somebody in Duluth knows that Robert Towne wrote the scene with the tomato plants where Brando dies.
Yeah.
You know, and so you don't have to change the credits. You just have to, you know, shift people's perceptions of who's responsible for individual scenes, or on a grander scale, certainly who's responsible for the movies themselves.
Well, also, the other thing that's odd about this, though, is, like, for example, say a movie, okay, I'm Crimson Tide.
You know, okay, yeah. Silly submarine blockbuster,
right.
But Quentin Tarantino was popped in, and you know exactly when he started writing, because it's the Silver Surfer comics.
Yes, of course. So, I mean, I think this is the sort of thing that a halfway smart critic with a little time on his hands, probably a little more time on his hands than the book critic for the San Francisco Chronicle has, but, you know, if the Schreiber theory takes off and there is continued interest, I mean, I envision a book that would be called something like The Lives of the Screenwriters, you know, modeled on the lives of the poets, that would go back and sort of excavate this whole generation of playwrights, of journalists, who many of them went west, although some of them, like Francis Marion, grew up in the Bay Area, went down to Southern California, and became, you know, one of the premier screenwriters of her day, one of the best compensated screenwriters of her day. Basically, you know, reinscribe these stories where they've been so effaced, mm-hmm. over the years, and you know, talk about the trajectory of a screenwriter's life. I mean, I was just reading this morning in Talking Pictures by Richard Corliss, which tried to do a little bit what I'm doing in the 1970s, and yet, to my mind, overemphasized older movies at the expense of new ones, not because the older ones weren't masterpieces, but because what you look for in a film book, what I thrived on when I was reading Leslie Halliwell's Filmgoer's Companion, or even Sarris's The American Cinema, which is like the principal exponent of the auteur theory stateside, is you go to a movie, and then you come home, and you pull the book down, and you want to compare your opinions with theirs. And that's difficult when, you know, you're only writing about older films, especially nowadays when older films aren't really shown in revival theaters anymore because DVDs have taken over the market.
Yeah, but, like, for example, Warner has just issued just endless, great, beautiful sort of masters of, like, you know, like they have the Controversial Classics Collection, I'm a Fugitive of a Chain Gang, and, like, all these great movies in one box set. The film noir collections that they've been
right.
Putting out, but they've been, the thing is they're, like, almost as good, if not better, than Criterion. You
really?
Know? Yeah, you should check it out, yeah.
I'll have
Warner
to chase
box
this
sets
down.
Are, like, they also put out, like, they put out the Cary Grant collection.
Yeah.
They just recently put out the Errol Flynn. It's, like, all of his stuff from, like, you know, Adventures of Robin Hood to what they had, any, what the Warner catalog had, to They Died with Their Boots.
With their boots on.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And the Gary Cooper collection just came
yes.
out. But, I mean, what I do when I hear about these new DVD collections is I think, why Cary Grant and not, you know, Dudley Nichols?
Or Paddy Chayefsky, yeah.
Or Paddy Chayefsky, exactly. And, of course, the answer to that is this man is a movie star and movie stars sell DVDs. But, you know, directors, I think, are a much more tenuous case. And yet you see these collections
yeah.
devoted to the work of a single director. You would think some smart DVD marketing head at a studio would think to himself, well, okay, we've already come out with the Cary Grant collection. We've already come out with the Billy Wilder collection.
Or you have, like, the Billy Wilder scripts, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, God knows everybody under the sun wants to be a screenwriter. To
yeah.
a much greater extent, at this point, probably want to be a director, because for a director, you need to have social skills.
Yeah.
You need to be able to manipulate people. And writers, you know, writers, God love them,
yeah.
just need to sit alone in a room and...
Well, not necessarily, because in Hollywood, they actually have to have social
have
skills
to pitch, yes.
pitch, yes.
It would be interesting to do some sort of study of, you know, that moment in Hollywood history when having newspaper clips or a track record as a playwright you know, sufficient ground to get into the writer's room at Warner's or MGM, you know, the moment when that changed and it became a necessary skill as the studios broke down, not just to write well, but to go into an office and be able to talk a story well. Because
there's a book right there.
Yeah.
Track that story down, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, because that, you know, I think you probably see a sea change that has its consequences and not necessarily hopeful consequences for the kinds of movies that get made and how they get made.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just...
Well, John Huston, for example, noted recounter,
yes.
noted, hung out with everyone, and also a damn good dialogue writer.
Excellent.
Now, here's the interesting thing. How much of his social skills played into getting his, you know, getting his movies made?
I'm sure to a
yeah.
great extent they did, but Huston is a very interesting case because he is sort of a notorious exception to the auteur theory.
Yeah.
Largely because he refused to make the same movie over and over and again, over
yeah.
and over again.
Yeah.
You know, he presented a problem to Sarris and before him to Truffaut and these people because you couldn't typecast him in the way John Ford was, you know, the great epic director of Westerns, or Hitchcock was the master of suspense. You know, in a way you get punished for your own versatility.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't have two different films than The Man Who Would Be King and The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
No, they're very different.
I mean, you know, but at the same time, they touch upon the same theme of, like, going out there and exploring last hurrah kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, it's just a question of looking a little closer and seeing likeness where before only, you know, dissimilarity was apparent. And this is what a critic does. This is what I do. This is how I got hooked on this in the first place. I was a film critic years ago. Went into book criticism because basically the worst book, if you pick it right, is going to be so much better than the worst movie. And I
did
film
criticism myself.
Did
so
I can tell.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I just started to think, you know, here I am reading, you know, the new Philip Roth novel comes over the transom. Yep. The first thing you do is you go back and you look at the Philip Roth novels you already know and love, and you try and put the new one into context. And, you know, this is what I used to try and do with directors' movies, and oftentimes they just didn't work. You know, you could stare at it until you were cross-eyed, and all you could really see was a certain desperation common to all the movies where the director was so relieved to get a green light that he took a project for which he wasn't necessarily suited, and, you know, the filmography becomes a mishmash. Whereas if you look at the screenwriters, because, you know, writing, you're a writer, you know these things, you can't write unlike yourself if you tried. It's like looking at a voice print of yourself trying to do a foreign accent. Voice prints don't lie, and it looks like you. You can't disguise your fingerprints, and you can't disguise your writerly stamp. And so this is what makes Schreiberist criticism, as I hope someday I won't have to blush to call it, both viable and tremendously challenging.
Kibbutism, maybe.
Yeah, that I think is pushing it. I mean, even Saras didn't go that far. Although, just reading Richard Corliss, he comes up with all these great adjectives like trombonian, Murnauvian for F.W. Murnau.
Oh,
so, yes.
Really?
Murnauvian, like Shavian. So, yeah, I mean, this should actually, now that I think about it, be the next job. Once I can create a pantheon, as the auteurist came up with a pantheon for, you know, auteur directors, I need to come up with witty adjectival forms for each of their last names. You know, Townian, not great. Who else am I thinking? You keep looking at it. Time?
The problem is I'm this disc is going to run out very, very soon.
Oh, I don't want to take it.
Yeah, no problem. But anyway, I'll conclude at least the taping and say it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Ah, okay. By all means.
Yeah.